Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the Madison newspaper Isthmus has filed a lawsuit against Madison's police department over an open records request that has gone unfulfilled for over a year. We'll look at that case and what it means for the state. First, the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped nearly 1,200 points yesterday, effectively wiping out the gains the index had made so far this year. The sudden drop had a ripple effect throughout the global stock markets. The Dow did rebound from some of its losses yesterday, closing at nearly 25,000 points this afternoon. But the sudden drop yesterday had some people worried that it could be the sign of volatility to come. Akani Otani is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal in New York, where she covers the U.S. stock market and investing. Akani, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about that drop yesterday, first of all, and put it in perspective. The raw number, nearly 1,200 points, is a big number, a record, right? But percentage-wise, how does it stack up to past drops?
Well, it was still pretty crazy. It was the largest one-day percentage decline since 2011. So it had been quite some time since we saw a drop of that scale for this U.S. stock market.
And then talk about what we saw today.
Well, perhaps even crazier, we really saw whipsaw action in trading. I mean, we started out with stocks sliding again very quickly down several hundred points, and only in the last half hour of trading we saw a rapid rebound and the Dow ending 567 points higher. So it was really volatile. We saw a lot of swings, and I think investors are expecting to see perhaps a bit more of this choppy trading as the week goes on.
And Akani, I assume you and a lot of other people are trying to answer the question, what's going on? What led to this? You know, we had this long, gradual rise leading to these record levels. And now what's going on in the last few days? What made this happen?
Yeah, well, it's complicated because, you know, it sort of started last Friday. We saw selling pressure pick up in the U.S. stock market, and some people were blaming this rise in government bond yields that we've been seeing over the last couple of weeks, as well as some wage growth figures that we saw in the monthly employment report, suggesting that perhaps inflation, which has sort of long been dormant, might be picking up. But, you know, some investors were sort of saying, you know, it's not really so much about that. The economic picture hasn't really changed over the last week or so. And perhaps it's more a function of how long it had been since we really saw any kind of volatility in the market. Up until this week, we hadn't seen a 5% drawdown from a recent high in more than 300 trading days. So to some people, it's more sort of a sign of how long we'd gone without a significant pullback.
So the idea that this isn't any cause of anything bad in particular happening, it was just kind of overdue, maybe.
Yeah, I think that's sort of the sense that we're hearing from portfolio managers and analysts. I mean, clearly a drop of that scale that we saw yesterday is notable, and it's going to freak some people out. But it seems like most people are saying, you know, their view of the economy hasn't changed at all from where we were last Monday.
Yeah, thinking back to 2008 when we saw the markets falling, it seems like there were reasons companies were having big problems. It turned out a lot of their value was based on an elaborate fiction in some ways over a mortgage debt that they owed, things like that, or mm-hmm. that they owned. There's nothing like that going on that people are pointing toward, right?
No, and it seems like the opposite situation, in fact. I mean, we're seeing companies in the S&P 500 heading toward their sixth consecutive quarter of earnings growth. We're seeing economists at the IMF saying that they expect global growth to accelerate again. And we're still seeing central banks around the world largely on this sort of easy money policy that they put in place after the 2008 crisis. So in many respects, I think people are saying that there are significant differences in where we are and sort of in the health of the economy.
Akani Otani is with us from the Wall Street Journal, looking at a wild few days in the stock market. Akani, how does this affect investors, from the people who are heavily invested in the stock market, people who have 401ks that they're looking at? Does a three-day weird cycle like this have a real impact on people?
I think ideally, it should not. I started seeing on Twitter a lot of people joking, don't look at your 401k today. Just don't look at it at all, because the truth is, I think, some people are going to be upset. I mean, even as a markets reporter, it is kind of upsetting to to think of, you know, how much your account may have changed over the last couple of days. But the point is to sort of focus on the long term, and I think that's why we're hearing a lot of financial advisors recommending to their clients that they shouldn't be making any drastic changes to their portfolio this week, just based off of the selling that we saw the last two trading days. Instead, they should be looking at the fundamental picture and, you know, asking themselves, has it changed? And with so many people saying no, I mean, it really hasn't. The economic picture is still exactly the same as where we were last week. I think most advisors would say, well, then you should stay put and, you know, don't let your emotions sort of override your thinking process here.
Sometimes we chalk up weird Wall Street swings to emotions and people panicking and things like that. I've seen people point toward algorithms and computer-controlled trading as maybe one of the reasons things swing in weird directions. Is that something that's happening?
Yeah, I mean, and that's been one of the big sort of mysteries that I think everyone's been trying to unravel today, is what exactly happened. Because as much as we can talk about, you know, the rise in bond yields, the jobs report, the sense that a pullback was sort of long overdue, there seemed to be definitely a sort of machine-based component in the selling, particularly yesterday. A lot of traders were noting the selling accelerating really at a pace that seemed not human around, you know, the 3 o'clock sort of hour. We saw the Dow just tumbling more than 1,000 points quickly, and it didn't seem to coincide with any release of news or economic reports. And so that, to a lot of people, suggested that perhaps there were certain algorithmic bets that were sort of being automatically triggered at certain levels that were contributing to the sell-off.
This seems to me like it would be one of the biggest challenges to somebody in your line of work, Akani, trying to look at this extremely complex system with human and robot actors making these decisions, basically, and trying to ascribe reasons to it. Sometimes there's a clear reason, and sometimes it's like, you know, go to the Oracle of Delphi and figure out what happened there.
Totally. And I think that's where, you know, you have to be honest with people. The fact is that sometimes, you know, no one really knows exactly why. We still don't really know 100% the reason that stocks started selling off last Friday. But I think that's why, you know, it's helpful to not only look at what the numbers are doing, but also talking to, you know, traders on the floor and portfolio managers and looking at sort of what retail investors are doing and sort of piecing it together that way.
So we had a Friday, as you mentioned, with some drops, the big drop yesterday, up and down today with a little rise. What are you watching for over the next few days to see if we get back to boring again?
Well, I think we'll be sort of holding our breath, watching what markets in Asia and Europe do, and watching what U.S. stock futures do, to sort of get a sense of what we may see as traders wake up in New York tomorrow. And I think just sort of keeping track of some of the fallout that we've seen the last couple of days. We've seen a number of funds sort of tied to bets on low volatility shutting down in the last 24 hours or so, as those bets sort of spectacularly failed. So I think that'll be another interesting component to track.
Just to follow up on that last point, there's an investment based on how volatile, how wiggly the stock market is. Like I could invest, I won't. I could invest in how chaotic things are going to be or unchaotic.
Yeah, essentially, there's been this thing that some people call the Wall Street's fear gauge. Other people call it the VIX. And it's been really popular in 2017 and sort of the start of this year to bet that this thing would stay low sort of forever, just based off of the premise that everything seems rosy in the economic front, so it doesn't really seem like we should expect large swings in the market. Obviously, that's sort of a failing bet over the long term, because you're always going to see volatility return at some point. And so this was sort of the week that those bets did really backfire for a lot of people.
We'll leave it at the fear gauge. Akani, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Akani Otani is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal in New York, where she covers the U.S. stock market and investing. She joined us to talk about the wild ride on the stock market over the last few days. Right now, Madison's alt-weekly paper, Isthmus, is suing the Madison Police Department over a 13-month-old records request that had been approved but not filed. Or filled, I should say. Isthmus has joined forces with the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty on this case. The group released a press release stating that the delay of the request has, quote, prevented journalists from doing their job to seek truth, provide transparency, and inform the public. Judith Davidoff is an editor and reporter for Isthmus. Judith, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you so much.
Also joining us is Tom Kamenick, Deputy Counsel and Litigation Manager at the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Tom, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, Judith, filing opens records request is a common procedure for a news outlet. What does the process usually go like?
Well, there really is no usually. I mean, there are often delays, as is noted in this complaint. But sometimes, you know, records are, the request is filled in a more timely manner. It's usually filed by email. There's usually an exchange after that. Oftentimes, the news agency or requester, because often it can just be a private citizen, is asked to further define the scope of the request. And then it's really left to the custodian to fulfill that request.
And Tom, before we get into the particulars of this case, why are open records an important part of accountability to the point where your organization gets involved in a case like this?
Yeah, this is really a major nonpartisan issue as far as open government is concerned. It's often been quoted that sunshine is the best of disinfectants. For an informed populace to be participating in an act of democracy, it's important for people who are voting and who are contacting their representatives to know exactly what's going on in government. What is government doing with its resources? How is it allocating them? What are individuals doing with those?
And then getting into this case, Judith, a records request filed back in December of 2016. Talk us through the story. What is the story and what were you looking for there?
Well, you know, you sometimes never know exactly what the story is, but, you know, there was information out there that there was potentially internal knowledge of an officer's conduct. You know, this officer, Steve Heimsness, was ultimately involved in the fatal shooting of a local musician, Paulie Heenan. The officer was later vindicated of any, let's say, wrongdoing by the Dane County District Attorney and the police department itself. He was subsequently released from the department for reasons unrelated potentially to that shooting. But in any case, you know, we were told that there might be a story of certain information within the department by employees within the department. And so we followed up with an opens records request to see if, you know, the records would bear out some kind of story.
And what happened? What happened then after filing this open records request?
Yeah, there was a lot of back and forth. You know, the initial former public radio reporter, Gil Halstead, had put in the initial request. He knows Dylan and was working with Dylan. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, the department asked that the records request be, that the scope be narrowed. That was done. And then there was a lot of back and forth in emails about, you know, when these records would be actually produced. I should note, as I think you did earlier, that that we did pay for the records that we were told would be forthcoming, you know, pretty soon into the process.
And that's where things get tricky. It sounds like the open records request was approved. It's paid for. It'll be coming out pretty soon. But now we're about 13 months since the request. What have you heard lately?
Actually, we haven't heard anything lately. I think the last contact we had, I believe, was back in August. No, I'm sorry. After that, there was an email with an assistant city attorney about it. But so that was post August of 2017. I actually don't have it right here when we emailed the assistant city attorney. I'm sure it's in the complaint.
We're talking about an open records request lawsuit involving Isthmus, the weekly newspaper in Madison, and the group Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, targeting the Madison Police Department, and about the wider issue of open records in general. Let's bring you back in now, Tom. Why get involved? Why is this a legal case now over the slow response here on this open records request?
So the open records law says that record custodians need to provide access to the records, quote, as soon as practicable and without delay. That language is not as precise as it might appear in some other states with open records laws, but the Attorney General of the state has, in his guidance, suggested that 10 business days is a reasonable amount of time for most straightforward record requests. And here at Will, we get a lot of phone calls from people who are faced with these kind of delays. Or I should say not quite these kind, because typically I haven't seen anything over maybe 6 or 7 months in the past. This one with Isthmus is really egregious, and I haven't seen anything like it. But it's a major problem that we see in places around the state. Now, to be fair, there are plenty of custodians out there who are good and conscientious public servants who get records requests done post-haste. But there are others who slow walk them either through intentional delay or through just, I know, negligence or not taking enough care to make responding to record requests a priority. But it is supposed to be a basic function of government, so we are filing a lawsuit to make sure that function is followed through on.
And, Tom, have you received any response from the police department, the Madison Police Department, in regards to this decision to bring this to the courts?
I can't speak to that yet.
Gotcha. So, Judith, if the records came out, you know, after the show today, would that be it? Would the case be over?
You know, actually, I think that's more of a Tom question.
Okay, Tom, go for it.
I don't know if what that means legally.
So one of the difficulties we face, not only lawyers face that deal with these issues, but that reporters and other curious citizens face is that the courts have not yet established any kind of clear guidance on how long is too long. And so one of the things we're hoping to establish in this case is not only to get the records, but to get a court ruling on whether or not 13 months is too long. So we don't know exactly where the line is, but we feel pretty confident 13 months is on the wrong side of it.
Tom, on a legislative level, would you like to see state law change to actually put a number on how long is too long, on what timely means?
Some states do. The federal government does as well for Freedom of Information Act requests. The Freedom of Information Act also gives federal agencies the right to give themselves kind of unlimited extensions, so that's not really all that effective. Speaking purely on my own behalf here and not on behalf of any clients, I've always thought that it would work very well to put a deadline in the statute, in the law, whereby if the custodian takes longer than whatever the deadline is set at, they can no longer charge location fees. Because those often become a serious impediment to getting access to records when custodians charge hundreds or thousands of dollars to do searches. And removing their ability to charge if they take too long would be a great incentive for them to get them done quickly.
And Judith, can you talk a little bit more about the role of open records requests, both in journalism and for the public at large?
Well, I think that, you know, documents and facts and evidence are what journalists need to do their work. You need to have that primary material that backs up an argument, that backs up what, you know, someone's being accused of. There are people who, you know, often can't come forward and put their names to something that they know is going on for fear of retaliation, of losing their jobs, all sorts of things. And so the ability to get to the actual record, you know, as a third party is essential to doing our job.
And Tom, this is a Madison case, a Madison newspaper, a Madison Police Department. Could a ruling have implications for the state as a whole?
If it goes to a higher court, yes. Any ruling by this court wouldn't necessarily affect other cases around the state. But if we do wind up going to the Court of Appeals or even the Wisconsin Supreme Court, we could then establish guidelines that custodians around the state would have to follow.
And Tom, what's the timeline here now that this is going to the courts? Any idea when this could be argued, maybe ruled on?
So the court has just issued an order requiring the police department to either turn over the records by March 6th or to appear at a hearing in front of the court on March 6th to explain why they aren't turning them over. So we'll have to see what they do before that point.
And Judith, is this a unique case from your perspective as a journalist? Have you seen a delay this long in an open records request before?
I personally haven't seen a delay this long, for sure. I mean, I've seen other cases where, where records were requested and then was essentially moot because it was a case at the Cap Times against them. Suing for records on judicial appointees, and the interview material wasn't released until the announcement was made about the who the governor had chosen. So that, you know, kind of sabotaged the reporting on that piece. But no, I've never seen a record take this long.
Thanks to both of our guests, Judith Davidoff from Isthmus, Madison's all-weekly newspaper, and Tom Kamenick, Deputy Counsel and Litigation Manager with the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, talking about an open records lawsuit against the Madison Police Department. First, some might call them dad jokes. A colleague here refers to them as the cilantro of humor, and some people just can't resist the urge to deliver one whenever there's an opportunity. We're talking about puns now. Webster's Dictionary defines a pun as the, quote, usually humorous use of a word in such a way as to suggest two or more of its meanings or the meaning of another word similar in sound. Note the use of the word usually in that definition. We love our puns here at WPR, so we asked our staff to share some of their favorites, and then we asked two of our classical music hosts to read them. Here they are.
I'm Norman Gilliland.
I'm Stephanie Elkins, and you're listening
to Wisconsin Punblick Radio.
There was a man who entered a local newspaper's pun contest. He sent in 10 different puns in the hope that at least one of them would win. Unfortunately, no pun intended.
A guy just threw milk at me.
How dare he?
What's the difference between a hippo and a Zippo? One is really heavy, the other is a little lighter.
Pop singer Rick Astley will let you borrow any Pixar movie from his collection except one. He's never gonna give you up.
Never have puns been delivered with more dignity. Do you love puns or hate them? Is there a favorite that you'd like to share? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Ronnie Jacobson joins us now. She's a freelance science journalist in New York City. She wrote an article that looks at what's happening in the human brain when we hear a pun. Ronnie, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much.
Well, before we get into the science, Ronnie, are you a pun person? Do you appreciate them, or are you one of the people who cringes when you hear them? Respect either way.
I am definitely a pun person. I think we should stop apologizing for punning and just own it.
And why would scientists be interested in what's happening in our brain when we hear a pun?
Well, punning is a pretty old thing, and there's a lot happening with the pun. Scientists have been studying it for a while. It can tell us just how the two hemispheres of the brain interact. It tells us how we appreciate how and why We appreciate humor, what we find funny, all sorts of things.
Yeah, it's kind of a meta operation for the brain. Like, language is complicated enough, but that's when it's working like it's supposed to. A pun is a whole different level, right? Because our brain has to take this language part and then figure out why it doesn't work, and I guess why it's funny if it doesn't.
Exactly.
So you wrote a while back about this study at the University of Windsor in Ontario. Tell us about the study. What were they trying to figure out there, and how did they do that?
So the scientists were trying to figure out exactly what is happening in the brain when we hear puns or when we see puns, because puns are often written. And so what they did, the scientists, Tara McHugh and Laurie Buchanan at the University of Windsor, Ontario, they used a divided visual field experiment, so because of the way the brain is wired, what's presented to the left eye gets interpreted in the right side of the brain, which is generally thought to be the more creative side, and then what's presented to the left eye gets what's presented to the right eye gets interpreted in the left side of the brain, which is thought to be the side of the brain responsible for language and learning. So using this experimental design, what the researchers did was they presented subjects with a series of puns in either their left or right visual fields, their left or right eye, and asked them to identify the primary meaning of the pun so that is most related to the rest of the sentence, and the secondary meaning of the pun, so that kind of trick, surprise meaning. And the subjects tended to respond much faster to the primary meaning. They identified the primary meaning faster when it was presented to the left side of their brain. So that indicated to the researchers that there's a priming effect in the left side of the brain. That is, the left side interprets the primary meaning of the pun first and faster than it does the secondary meaning, which, you know, it sets off a chain reaction whereby the secondary meaning is kind of, there's that disconnect that's identified, and then the secondary meaning, the brain can then say there's something else going on here.
So there's maybe a time lag in our brain before we hit that initial bit and then the second part. And I guess we've all kind of felt that hearing the pun in a way, right?
Right, exactly. It's a very, you know, split second, less than a second time lag, but it's there.
It seems like it might work differently for some people. There was a joke about a relative of mine, don't tell them a joke on Saturday night because they'll start laughing in church the next morning. I mean, it could take a different amounts of time for us to puzzle it out, can't it?
Oh, sure. Yeah. All of these things having to do with the brain are individual, but that would be generally the way a pun works and is interpreted.
We're talking about puns with science writer Ronnie Jacobson, and you can join in. Are you a pun fan, or do you resent them and despise them as a form of humor? You could call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And if you have a pun to share, you could tell us about that, too. Ronnie, getting back to the science, does this study tell us anything or confirm things we've learned about humor related to people who have suffered certain brain injuries?
Yeah, it does. The study itself was mostly told us what's happening with the left side of the brain. It showed that, as I said, that is the primary place or where the kind of pun first goes to. But there have been lots of previous studies about humor and humor appreciation showing that people with lesions in the right side of their brain have tend to have deficits in how they appreciate humor. Maybe they don't think things are funny anymore, or they're laughing at inappropriate times. And this study very much jibes with that, because one of the main conclusions was that the right side is kind of what's responsible for cluing us in to the punchline of the joke.
And I read, and you looked at this too, I guess, there's something in German called Witzelsucht, also known as joke addiction. So our brains can actually do something weird where we get hooked on puns and other jokes.
Yeah, Witzelsucht. It's a very interesting thing. It's first diagnosed back in the 1800s, which I didn't know before. These people who have it just cannot stop making puns or, you know, what are considered bad jokes. Most people who have this, they literally can't stop themselves, and they tend to find themselves very funny, but nobody around them does. And so there's this thought that because these people tend to have lesions or, you know, problems with the right side of their brain, it just goes to that point that the right side is what is cluing us into where the joke actually lies, what is actually funny.
And Ronnie, before we let you go, do you have a pun or two you want to leave us with?
Well, one of my favorite puns was from a restaurant I used to drive by a lot when I lived in Atlanta, which is sadly closed now. The name of the restaurant was Let Us Surprise You. And I just got a kick of that every time I drove by. And another great Groucho Marx pun, with, if you don't like my parties, you can leave in a huff. If that's too soon, leave in a minute and a huff.
Oh, that's a good one. Ronnie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure thing.
That's Ronnie Jacobson, freelance science journalist in New York City, talking about the science surrounding puns and wordplay. And now it's your turn. We're going to start taking your calls in just a minute. Do you have a favorite pun you'd like to share? Do you love puns? Do you hate them? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll get your calls in just a few moments here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We are talking about puns. We just heard some of the science behind the pun and what's going on in the brain. And now it is your turn to share your favorite puns, what you love or hate about puns at 800-642-1234. Or you can go to the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go to your calls now. We've got Jeff on the line in Superior. Jeff, you've got a Superior pun to share for us?
Well, I'm always looking at politics. And with what's going on with Congress, I was thinking if Reese Witherspoon was in Congress right now, someone might say, thanks for the memo, Reese.
Jeff, thanks. That would be a good moment in politics. Are you a pun collector yourself, Jeff?
Yeah, I mean, I use puns all the time.
And everybody around you loves you for it, right?
Yeah, they can kind of count on one.
Jeff, thank you so much for starting us off. We'll go next to Lissy in Green Bay. We got Jim in Riceland on the air. Actually, Jim, hi.
Hi, I'm a lawyer, and I want to give a couple of quick lawyer puns. Do you know how the lawyer got the dog to testify at trial?
I do not.
Well, he refused to give an affidavit, so the lawyer had to take his deposition.
All right, good. I've heard lawyer jokes. I haven't heard lawyer puns before. You got another one for us?
Oh, yes, quickly. California has the most attorneys, and New Jersey has the most landfills. You know why?
Why?
It's because New Jersey had first choice.
Jim, that's more of a joke, right, than a pun, but I'll take it. Thank you so much. We are taking your best or worst puns at 800-642-1234. Let's go down to Lissy in Green Bay. Lissy, hi.
Hi.
What do you have for us, Lissy?
I guess it's more like a bad joke than a pun, but, I mean, those are pretty good too, right?
Uh-huh.
So what do you call a cow with no legs?
What?
Ground beef.
Okay, see, I get it, and I think that fits the pun category because it works off the double meaning of the word ground. So I'm gonna rule that a pun with my duly appointed authority here. Lissy, are you a big pun fan yourself, Lissy?
I love puns. I think they're so funny.
And do you ever get, like, the negative reaction, like the groan? Is that what you're looking for when you share a pun?
I like when other people laugh, but there's one guy that I work with that constantly groans, and he I like to tease him that he's only groaning because he's upset that he actually wants to laugh at it.
Okay, that's fair. Lissy, thank you so much for sharing that. If you were trying to get in, some lines have opened up, 800-642-1234. Diane is on the line in Manitowoc. Diane, what's your pun story?
Well, my pun story involves work. Where I work, our team has a whiteboard, and every week for probably the last couple of years, we write puns on it.
Oh, really? And so the whole team gets in on this?
The whole team can, yes. There's usually only a few of us that contribute, but the rest of the team enjoys it. And then when people come and visit our area, they enjoy them also.
The rest of the team enjoys it. Now, you say that. Would the rest of the team say they appreciate the pun board, too?
Yeah, they really kind of do, yes. And we get a lot of groans, and that means it's a pretty good pun.
All right, Diane, thank you so much. A pun board at work. I like the sound of that. We are taking your puns and why you like or dislike puns at 800-642-1234. I want to go back to our own classical music host, Stephanie Elkins and Norman Gilliland. They recorded some of WPR's favorite puns. Here's some more of what they had to share.
What do you call a snobbish criminal walking down the stairs? A condescending condescending.
To the mathematician who invented zero, thanks for nothing.
I've accidentally swallowed some Scrabble tiles. My next trip to the bathroom could spell disaster. Oh my God.
Stephanie couldn't quite hold that one together, and understandably so. Back to your calls now. Peter is on the line in Brookfield. Peter, hi.
How you doing?
Good. What do you got for us, Peter?
You know, I'm a little bit tired today. I was up all night watching this new sports channel. It's actually involving origami sports.
Uh-huh.
I heard that it's going to fold soon. So I hurried up and signed for it because you only get it on pay-per-view.
Pay-per-view for my origami sports. Peter, did you spend some time folding that one together, or do these just pop into your head?
I did, but, I've been accused of being a real cut-up, so it just kind of comes naturally.
All right, Peter, thank you so much. A good series of paper puns there. Now to Tyra on the line in La Crosse. Tyra, hi.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. What pun do you have for us, Tyra?
Well, a sign in Daytona Beach, Florida, driving down A1A, and there was a bar that had a porpoise on the sign, and it said, come on in and have a drink with a porpoise instead of a purpose.
All right. Tyra, thank you so much. A nice visual pun. And are you somebody who generally appreciates a good pun?
Oh, I love them. They make me laugh.
Thank you so much, Tyra. We are collecting puns here, for better or worse. You can call in at 800-642-1234. Tim joins us next in Appleton. Tim, hi.
Hello.
What do you got for us, Tim?
I have a definition of politics.
Uh-oh. Okay.
It comes from the Greek, of course. Poly meaning many, and pix, blood-sucking insects.
Now, I feel like I've heard that one. O'Rourke, P.J. O'Rourke, is that one of his, maybe?
I don't know where it came from.
But I love that one. Tim, thank you so much. Do you love a good political pun?
I love puns of any kind.
Of any kind. Okay, and I've been asking a lot of people this. Do you annoy those around you with them, or do they like the puns?
I think it swings both ways.
Okay. Double-edged sword, Tim. Thanks for the call. We'll go next to Alexis with us in Milwaukee. Alexis, hi.
Hi.
Hi, do you have a pun for us?
I do.
What is it?
Two peanuts were walking down the street. One was assaulted.
That is a classic, Alexis. Thank you so much for sharing that pun with us. Let's get back to our classical music puns with dignity here. Stephanie Elkins and Norman Gilliland. Another round of puns from them.
What is the difference between a cat and a comma? One has claws at the end of its paws, and the other is a pause at the end of the claws.
Hey, did you hear about those new corduroy pillows?
Yeah. They're really making headlines.
Did you hear the CEO of Chiquita resigned? She grew tired of the pressure of being top banana banana. Oh, my God. I can hardly stand it.
Thanks to Stephanie and Norman, people who do really have a good sense of humor on and off the air, for surviving those three rounds of puns. Back to your calls now. We are taking your puns and your love or disapproval of the pun in general at 800-642-1234. Gary is with us in Wausau. Gary, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. Caught my ear. I remember 1 year ago when the gold medal skier Peekaboo Street was famous, and she got all these endorsements. So with a little philanthropy act, she added on to the hospital, and they called it Peekaboo ICU. I mean, I laughed the first time I heard it. That was pretty clever.
That is a pretty good one.
Thanks for your show.
Thank you, Gary, for calling in and sharing that one. 800-642-1234. Time for a few more puns. Hopefully people are still listening. Andrew with us in Superior. Andrew, hi.
Hi. I'd just like to thank you for such a punishing show.
Our bosses may punish me for this one. Actually, do you like the pun yourself, Andrew? Is that a favorite of yours?
Yes. Me and my roommate have pun wars all the time.
Really?
My wife starts groaning every time it starts.
Is there a judge?
Oh, usually whoever can make her groan the loudest wins.
Okay, that sounds great. Andrew, thanks a lot for sharing your pun at 800-642-1234. We go to Viroqua now with Trevor. Trevor, hi.
Hello. I just wanted to give a shout-out to the pun master, Carl Azus, and his writers. He's great. But, my pun is, why did the chicken cross the road?
Okay, why?
To get to the other side.
Wait a minute. To get to the other, that's the straight up original chicken cross the road joke. I didn't miss anything there, did I?
No, well, the other side of the road, but then it's an old chicken, and he crossed the road to get hit by a truck so he could get to the other side.
Ah, okay. All right. A little metaphysical humor there. Thanks a lot for that, Trevor. There are a lot of twists on that one. I didn't see that twist ending coming up, though. Looking for more puns, a few callers on the line now, 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We've got Lauren with us in Madison. Lauren, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What's your pun for us, Lauren?
I've got two science puns for you. One is two atoms are walking down the street. One says to the other, how's it going? He says, terrible. He says, why do you say that? Oh, I lost an electron. He says, are you sure? He says, yeah, I'm positive.
Okay, that's one. What else?
Why do you never trust an atom? Why do you never trust an atom?
I do not know.
Oh, hell, they make up everything.
Well, I've got one I heard from a scientist years ago. Did you hear about superconductors? They're too cool to resist. Laura, I take no credit or blame for that one. Lauren, do you look for science-themed puns in particular?
Oh, yeah, I do.
All right. Thank you so much for that, Lauren. I think we've got time to get another caller, if we can get that on the line here. Nope, maybe not. You could keep sharing your puns on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Just keep them coming up there, and tell us if you are known as a punster in the circles you move in, and if you do anything like some of our callers have mentioned, pun wars with a friend, a pun board at work, or if you've participated. There are events, I think, called Pundemonium that people put on locally where they have contests. We'd love to hear your stories there. Thanks to Norman Gilliland and Stephanie Elkins for adding some dignity to the undignified subject of puns and sharing a bunch of favorites from around Wisconsin Public Radio. Again, you can keep tweeting us at Central Time WPR or share your pun on the Ideas Network Facebook page. If you were online this morning, you may have started the day with some strange news that Doritos were going to come out. The Pepsi company was going to come out with a brand of Doritos made specifically for women. It Turns out it's not true. The sequence of events was the Pepsi CEO did an interview on Freakonomics, actually the podcast, and said, yeah, men and women snack differently. They're going to try to market it differently. Tabloids picked that up, said Lady Doritos are on the way. That got a lot of angry reaction. The proper press, New York Times, got to the bottom of it. This wasn't happening. But J. Carlisle Larson's in here. JC, do we need Doritos specifically for, or other snack foods
for women? I do think that Doritos are a pretty accessible chip for most people. Would I not mind it being more, the bag being less lightning theme or something like that? I feel like there's these like really aggressive themes to it, but I don't know aesthetically if it would be like a minimalist style to the marketing.
Now, the Pepsi CEO was saying, hey, women, maybe they don't want the loud crunch and they don't, you know, they're not, they don't want to, they want to be dainty. They don't want to lick the crumbs off the bag like guys do. And I'm like, I don't, that doesn't necessarily match the men and women I know as terms of snacking differences.
Oh, yeah, it has never stopped me before to just go to town on some Doritos. The crunch is not, I think, the problem. I think it's the emerging out of it being covered in orange and just like in a haze of Dorito pleasure, I suppose.
I'm there, too. So don't watch for Lady Doritos in the store near you.
I don't think we're going to get them.
This is Central Time.